Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, November 26th, 2023. My name is Bill McCann, and I'm going to read a featured story from the magazine. Everybody knows Flo from Progressive. Who is Stephanie Courtney? A polo shirt, a white apron, and a retro hairdo changed an actor's life forever. This is a story by Katie Weaver. One needn't eat Tostitos' hint of lime-flavored triangles to survive. Advertising's objective is to muddle the truth. Of course, hint of lime-flavored triangles have the advantage of being food, which humans do need to survive. Many commodities necessitated by modern life lack this selling point. Insurance, for example, is not only inedible, but intangible. It's a resource that customers hope to never need, a product that functions somewhat like a tax on fear. The average person cannot identify which qualities, if any, distinguish one company's insurance from another. For these reasons and more, selling insurance is a tricky business. In 2022, nearly half the active property and casualty insurance premiums in the U.S. and Canada were sold by just 11 companies. Increasingly, insurance corporations attract business not by building trust between their customer and local agents, but by successfully ascribing positive characteristics to the fictional characters who anthropomorphize the companies and products and ads. The first to arrive at the vigorous insurance brand character orgy was a gecko, created in 1999 to teach people how to pronounce the acronymic name of the Government Employees Insurance Company. Conceived as a single spot, Geico's Gecko campaign was extended the year a commercial actor strike prohibited live humans from filming ads. It has been since joined by the Aflac Duck, Liberty Mutual's Limu Emu, Professor Burke, J.K. Simmons, from Farmers, bum da bum da bum da bum, Jake from State Farm, and Mayhem from Allstate. But all of these are subordinate to a moderately whimsical employee character who's been persuading Americans to purchase insurance, or in some commercials reminding them that they already have. Since the twilight of the George W. Bush administration, Flo from Progressive. According to Ad Age, in 2022, the Progressive Corporation spent more than $2 billion on advertising in the United States, pouring more money into the effort than McDonald's, Toyota, or Coca-Cola. The insurance industry's total annual media ad spending is estimated to be just shy of $11 billion. More than was spent by all the top beer brands combined. Progressive's C-suite could justify the elaborate outlay as follows. A decade and a half ago, their executive ancestors stumbled upon advertising gold in the form of a story that Americans could bear to be told over and over again. So far, forever. It's an interminable folktale about buying insurance propelled by the charisma or connoted soothing attentiveness, or gently grating peskiness, or something of Flo, its central character. Flo debuted in 2008, working the checkout of an eldritch white store, uncannily devoid of shadows or edges. The original idea behind these ads, internally called the Superstore campaign, was to transform insurance from something people had to pay for into something people got to shop for. In early ads, the store's shelves were lined with packages of insurance, cornflakes, boxes, and tomato cans covered with Progressive branding. In Behind the Apron, the story of Flo, a Progressive-produced video, A company executive recalls that before Superstore, when asked to list car insurance companies they had heard of, even Progressive's own customers failed to name it. The extent to which Flo is responsible for the company's subsequent surge in popularity is impossible to quantify. The character is so inextricably linked with the brand that the two can no longer be separated for measurement. If it could be represented photographically, though, the relationship would look something like the inverse of the famous image from the psychologist Harry Harlow's experiment, in which a baby rhesus monkey cleaves to a wooden mother with the insensate entity fiercely clinging to the flesh and blood woman. A pair of Flo's blue high tops are displayed at Progressive headquarters in Ohio. In the company's online store, her likeness, in varying degrees of abstraction, adorns a lunchbox, an air freshener, a puzzle, a pin, a dog toy, a bobblehead, a chia pet, and the faces of multiple dolls of other nations, a Japanese kokeshi, and a family of Russian matryoshkas. The only Flo paraphernalia that doesn't feature her visage subsumes the buyer into her likeness, the Flo costume, with apron, name tag, pin, headband, and chestnut brown wig for $24.99, worn two Halloweens ago by Joe Jonas. The year the ads premiered, the company's chief marketing officer, Remy Kent, told me Progressive's stock price was under $15. It recently closed at $157.67. "Well, I can't give Flo all the credit," Kent said. "I think she's really become synonymous with the brand." In fact, the human face, voice, and bearing that constitute Flo are associated far more strongly with Progressive than with the 53-year-old woman who provides them, Stephanie Courtney. Courtney didn't intend to sell insurance. She meant to star on Broadway and then, following wish revision, to support herself as a comedic actress. Instead, she has starred in the same role for 15 years and counting, becoming in the process a character recognizable to nearly every American, a feat so rare her peers in this category are mostly cartoon animals. Since appearing in the first Flo spot in January 08, Courtney has never been absent from American TV, rematerializing incessantly in the same sugar-white apron and hoar-frost white polo shirt and cocaine-white trousers that constitute the character's unvarying wardrobe. It's true that her career didn't launch until she was 38, and most of her audience couldn't tell you her name or anything about her, and many of the attendees of the Groundlings improv show in Los Angeles, in which she still performs weekly, probably don't recognize her. Set all that aside, though, and Stephanie Courtney is one of the most successful actors in the world. I found Courtney in head-to-toe black at the restaurant in Studio City where we had arranged to meet, a photo negative of Flo on a suede sofa. Her purse immediately caught my eye. It appeared to be an emerald green handbag version of the $388 bubble clutch made by Cult Gaia, the trendy label whose fanciful purses double as objects d'art. Courtney handed it to me while rattling off tips for extending the shelf life of fresh eggs. It was a plastic carrying case for eggs, it turned out. Eggs she had brought me from her 6 backyard hens. "Did you think it was a purse?" she asked merrily. We were led to a small outdoor table abutting an immense dormant fire pit. "When they turn this on," Courtney said in a conspiratorial whisper, setting her actual handbag upon its concrete ledge, "it's going to be amazing to see this bag catch on fire." Indeed, it would prove exciting when, 2.5 hours later, flames leaped out of the pit with no warning. Courtney rescued her pocketbook just before it was engulfed. Over iced tap water, Courtney told me about the early years of her acting career, a carousel of enthusiastic rejection. Everyone in New York is like, "You're great." No. Subsidized by catering work, in 1998 she moved to Los Angeles and booked her first commercial, a 1999 Bud Light Super Bowl ad. "I was the girl in the back going like this," Courtney said, making a face that a girl in the back might make as two guys in the checkout line, short on cash, debated whether to purchase toilet paper or Bud Light. To her eye, the Bud Light toilet paper spot was suffused with a timeless quality, one that guaranteed it would play forever, she told herself, using the money it earned her to buy UGGs. Uggs. It turns out to play closer to a month. This was significant because of how big broadcast commercials tend to pay. Actors receive one sum for their day of work on set and residuals in 13-week cycles as long as it plays thereafter. Commercial work was intended to tide Courtney over until her comedy career took off. At open mics, she performed alongside ascendant comedians like Tig Notaro, Maria Bamford, and Retta. After years of classes, she was promoted to the upper echelons of the Groundlings Improv Troupe, a comedy mint that has pressed stars like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Rubens, and Melissa McCarthy into wide circulation, but is best known for stacking the cast of Saturday Night Live with performers who are not Stephanie Courtney. SNL would come to watch Groundlings' performances, and as Courtney recalled to me, they were like, "Stop sending her stuff in. Like, we're not interested." "I remember feeling so terrible," Courtney said, "and just embarrassed, like a weird shame, like I shouldn't even walk around." It wasn't as if SNL had declared a moratorium on Groundlings hires. The show signed her friend Kristen from Class, better known from 2005 to 12 as Saturday Night Live star Kristen Wiig. Wiig described Courtney to me as one of the funniest people I've ever known in my life. Supernaturally gifted at instantaneously inventing new characters. A master improviser. Effortless. She remembered a sketch in which Courtney played an excited stand-up waiting in the wings, listening to a prolonged fawny introduction before walking on stage to begin her set. "And as soon as she gets out, she falls really hard on her face," Wiig said, laughing. "She starts moaning and crying." And that was the sketch. The problem in the early 2000s was that people didn't love Courtney in a way that could be reliably monetized. She auditioned for the role of Joan on Mad Men, and the show's creator, Matthew Weiner, loved her, but not for Joan, for a character named Marge, a switchboard operator with whom other characters had almost no interaction. "I was so stinking broke," Courtney said. "Her car wouldn't go in reverse, but the repair cost something like $2,500, so she just drove it forward. This complicated traveling between auditions, but she had a method. She would pull into a spot, roll down her windows, and go inside. When she returned, she would give another performance, that of a woman discovering that her car would not start. 'Oh, no,' she would explain. 'Oh, shoot, oh, no, my car won't start.' And then I'd flag down someone and be like, 'Oh, I have an idea. What if I put it in neutral and you push it?' People love being generous. Someone always helped her, that poor woman. And I'd go to the next one and do the whole thing all over again." This act, Courtney describes as much better than whatever I did at the actual auditions, which didn't lead to much. By 2007, Courtney's life was all on credit cards, and her age was a number almost unheard of in scenic Southern California. Even the commercial gigs were slowing then. That winter, she was cast in an ad for an insurance company as a cashier. She arrived at 5:30 the morning of the shoot to have her bangs cut into her hair. "I didn't recognize myself, and texted a photo of the finished look from her flip phone to a guy she was dating, now her husband, a lighting designer at the Groundlings Theater. The first script ended with a customer, upon realizing the quality of deal he was receiving, saying, "Wow," to which the cashier, name tag Flo, was instructed only to have a funny reaction. Courtney's knee-jerk response was to scream, "Wow," back. "I say it louder," she added under her breath. Years of Groundlings tuition paid off in this instant. Progressive loved the ad lib. Within a couple of months of shooting the first ads, Courtney was asked to film more. The work eventually became so steady that she quit her day jobs. I just remember getting the check for the year, which never, ever in my life, she trailed off. The relief in her voice sounded as fresh as if it had just happened. "I owed my manager money," she said. "I owed my family members money." Her efforts to write sketches at home were constantly being interrupted by debt collectors. "And then I got that money, and I was just like, here, here, here," she mimed, handing it out. "Just here. Just get out of my life." About 3 years into the ads, Courtney's finances were evolving so rapidly that her manager advised her to get a business manager, which I did, she said. "And it's the advice I give to any other person who's like, I have a campaign, what do I do?" It's the advice she gave to Kevin Miles when he came to her home to chat over lunch about becoming Jake from State Farm. She also knows Doug, the guy in the Liberty Mutual emu commercials. In the absent glow of the patio's still dormant fire pit, Courtney and I considered the dinner menu, which included a small quantity of caviar costing a sum of American dollars, ominously, discreetly, vaguely, alarmingly, irresistibly, and euphemistically specified as market price. Hours earlier, my supervisor had told me preemptively and demonically that I was not to order and expense the market price caviar. Somehow, Courtney learned of this act of oppression, probably when I brought it up to her immediately upon being seated for dinner. To this, Courtney said, "I love caviar," and added that my boss can't tell her what she can have because she doesn't answer to him, goddammit. She charged the caviar to her own personal credit card and encouraged me to eat it with her, even as I explained weakly for 1 second that this is not allowed. Lock me up. Subsequently, pinning down the exact hows and whys of my consuming a profile subject's forbidden caviar took either several lively discussions with my supervisor, my guest, or about 1.5 hours of company time, his calculation. In his opinion, this act could be seen as at odds with my employer's policy precluding reporters from accepting favors and gifts from their subjects. The worry being that I might feel obligated to repay Courtney for caviar by describing her favorably in this article. Let me be clear. If the kind of person who purchases caviar and offers to share it with a dining companion who has been tyrannically deprived of it sounds like someone you would not like, you would hate Stephanie Courtney. In any event, to bring this interaction into line with company policy, we later reimbursed her for the full price of the caviar, $85 plus tip, so now she is technically indebted to me. Despite her face being central to the ad campaign, Courtney told me at dinner, where we otherwise dined with marvelous economy, that she is seldom recognized, maybe once a month, she estimated. She makes few in-person character appearances. "You might like Flo," she said, "but do you want to deal with her now against your will?" About a year into the campaign, she visited a friend who had informed her son that Flo would be stopping by. Courtney arrived as herself, no costume, but just the idea that the TV lady was suddenly in his home sent the child sobbing into his room. "It's almost like Santa Claus getting in your face," Courtney said, "and it's like, Ain't no gifts. There's no upside. She learned early that people enjoy spotting Flo in real life only if they realize who she is on their own. If, for instance, her mother-in-law excitingly informs a stranger that she is Flo, they don't like it. They really don't, she said. According to Progressive, 99% of consumers, defined by Remy Kent as everyone out there that has the potential to buy insurance from us, know Flo. Kent told me that the character scores high on likability, not only with the general market, but also with the black community and the Hispanic community. For years, Sean McBride, the chief creative officer of the Arnold Worldwide Advertising Agency, whose copywriters have written more than 200 TV spots for the Superstore campaign, received daily emails indicating that ads featuring Flo were very, very directly tied to people calling Progressive to inquire about switching insurance. Jumbling the puzzle of Flo's likability, according to Kate Lamberton, a professor of marketing at the Wharton School, is the possibility that what audiences enjoyed about Flo in 08 is not what they enjoy or think they enjoy about her in 2023. It could be that American brains, exposed to so many years of this ad campaign, now confuse the ease of processing Flo content, a quality reinforced through repeated exposure, was actually liking it. Research shows, Lamberton said, that familiarity can overpower distaste. Even if people find her annoying, they don't find her objectionable, Lamberton said. In fact, some people who don't like Flo do like Flo because any character trait they cite as a reason for disliking her reflects that there's a very strong memory trace. For advertisers, a character that stimulates mild irritation with every appearance is preferable to one that is innocuous, so long as the benign annoyance doesn't mutate into a strong negative association. Complaining about something trivial, Lamberton said, is a very comforting experience. One possible secret to Flo's appeal, suggested Lamberton, is that her appearance both conforms to and pokes fun at gender stereotypes because she's a little bit exaggerated. She looks a little bit like a quirky Snow White. The lightly retro hairdo may be comforting to people for whom feminine bouffants recall a halcyon social era. It can also be read as a wry visual gag juxtaposed against Flo's sexless, shapeless uniform. What makes the Superstore campaign not just notable but virtuosic is its freakish longevity. To stave off what Lamberton called the wear-out phase, when content becomes so familiar it's no longer effective, Arnold is perpetually altering the ads just enough to keep them novel. It has released Superstore spots shot in the style of a fuzzy 1970s after-school special, a 1990s sitcom, and a TMZ on TV-style paparazzi show. It has introduced co-workers, the squad, not to supplant Flo, but to further develop her character. She can interact with her colleagues more brusquely than with customers. Courtney has portrayed several members of Flo's extended family, including her grandfather. If we can think of the campaign as a sentient being seeking to prolong its survival, its mission is to generate ceaseless low-grade curiosity about the familiar character of Flo. Is this a new ad? Constitutes sufficient interest. McBride compared Flo's effect on insurance advertising to the influence of Iron Man on cinema. Robert Downey Jr. is so incredibly charming, fast-talking, but sort of self-effacing, whatever that is. And then every Marvel movie became that, he said. This is kind of the junior version of that. Lamberton placed the campaign in the vanguard of now ubiquitous trends like brand characters instantiating abstract concepts and commercials that function as ersatz sitcoms with years of storylines. flows surreal cheer, and the extent to which her enthusiasm for competitively priced insurance veers into pathological obsession are winks at an old-fashioned idea of advertising. The implication, through exaggeration, is that today's audiences are too sophisticated to be swayed by an unrealistic pitchman. Lamberton refers to this self-conscious style endemic in the current proliferation of funny insurance commercials as ironic advertising, ads that recognize they are a little bit ridiculous. When I told Remy Kent about online speculation that Progressive pays Courtney $1 million per year to star in commercials, Kent smiled silently at me for a few seconds without moving the muscles of her face 1 millimeter, like a buffering video of herself. It was only when I declared my own guess for Courtney's annual salary, a figure much higher than $1 million, that she stopped buffering, but kept smiling. "Well," Kent said, "that's a wide range, isn't it?" Second guess I put to Kent was a number hazarded by Phil Cassetti, a commercial agent at Stewart Talent. Cassetti's clients have appeared in ads for brands like Olive Garden and Verizon. Once, a young redhead served as the new face of Wendy's after its 2012 rebrand. By his estimation, the star of a splashy campaign along the lines of Superstore might reasonably expect to hit the $1 million mark after 4 or 5 years. Around the time of the Cronut and Blurred Lines in Courtney's case. 15 years in, Cassie said, an annual figure like $10 million would be in the fair ballpark. You know, sometimes in a commercial, there's a scene that takes place in a house. How many houses do you suppose the commercial auteurs need to borrow to pull that off? Zero. That's what movie magic is for. Perhaps one. In fact, on a gray morning this past spring, the people who make the Progressive commercials commandeered a whole block of houses to shoot scenes inside one family's appealingly nondescript home. There are specific neighborhoods in L.A. that don't look like L.A., Sean McBride told me. If you start paying attention, he said, you will notice the same homes reused constantly. In the tree-lined block, the Superstore team has trucked a quantity of equipment sufficient to stage a 3-hour Beyoncé concert on the moon. There are lights, cameras, actors, gleaming trailers, and portable heaters. It was, after all, 62 degrees outside. But most of the equipment just looked like equipment, like sturdy black tubs with lids, crates, clamps, poles, spaghetti heaps of power cords, racks of racks, extra large folded up things, rectangles and tubular items. Some of this arsenal had been used to transform the living room of one house into a black person's living room. Perhaps it already was one. But because regular people don't naturally style their dwellings in commercially approved ways, literally a representative from Progressive headquarters must walk through the set and approve every single item that will appear on camera. Because they have things like artwork, stupid, their own furniture, ugly, family photos, who's that? And Rubik cubes, forbidden, because Rubik cubes are trademarked. All of the aforementioned must be temporarily disappeared and replaced with narratively appropriate, legally generic this and that. If cars are present, their manufacturer logos are covered with abstract shapes of similar dimensions. Their license plates, upon inspection, cursively reading not California, but drive safely. This obfuscation process is called Greeking, as in, it's all Greek to me, as in, I can't tell what that says, but it definitely doesn't say Kia Optima for legal reasons. If my visit to the Superstore set can be taken as representative, being closely involved with the production of popular TV commercials for large national brands is the best possible outcome for a human life. The scale and complexity of the operation at the center of Courtney's work is eye-popping. Every fleeting football game interrupting Progressive ad is the product of hours of labor from more than 100 people. On set, a cat wrangler stood just out of frame, ready to pounce with a backup cat if the primary cat failed. Trays of licorice delights, crostini with prosciutto, cups of ethereal parfait were discreetly proffered at frequent intervals to people scrutinizing monitors. Every lens, light, and politely anxious face was turned heliotropically toward Courtney in a rented living room, trying to remember while delivering her line that Progressive was offering deals for new parents rather than two new parents, a possible meaningful distinction. This wasn't a critically acclaimed Hulu series. There was actually a lot riding on this. If needed to be the same but slightly different and every bit as successful as the 200 that had come before it, so that everyone would be asked to return to this job, not necessarily, perhaps not exactly the job of their dreams, but a better job than anyone could ever hope for, bolstered by friendly faces and fantastic catering and a sumptuous corporate budget. In perpetuity. Many entertainers progress from commercial work, young Leonardo DiCaprio for Bubble Yum, to critical acclaim. Some later double back to endorsement work to cash in on their renown. Less young Leonardo DiCaprio for the Guangdong Oppo Mobile Telecommunications Corporation. Few in either stage find their likenesses permanently welded to a multi-billion dollar company. Courtney continued auditioning for other ads even after landing Progressive, but suspected that even casting directors who liked Stephanie Courtney refused to hire Flo. She could have avoided what has become an indelible association by abandoning the role early on, but she almost certainly could not have been as successful as an actor had she not played Flo for 15 years. Few actors are. Yet Courtney cannot but envy some of her peers flourishing from projects they've written themselves. I'm as competitive or hotter to myself or compare and despair as anybody, she said. She feels pressure, self-inflicted, to pursue a creative endeavor that is solely hers. I am writing something just for my, I shouldn't even say this, but I'm writing something for myself, she said. It's a comedic script set in a high school, like the one where her father worked. I don't even think I should waste my time trying to pitch it to anybody, Courtney told me, because I understand that it would be received politely, be a great meeting, would have water, but no matter how funny she is in real life, she knows people are not clamoring to hear more from the Progressive lady about her ideas for feature-length comedy films. If she ever did make a go of it, I would probably finance it, she said. I will probably take my kids' college money. There are moments when Courtney's every day is disrupted by a flashing recollection of her good fortune. A while ago, she and her husband were discussing possible home improvements, some tedious projects they should get around to. I remember thinking in an annoyed tone, well, how can life be better than it is now? The idea made them laugh. It's worth more than money, Courtney said, to feel like you have enough. But other things might be worth more than money too. Things like knowing you've told a story that inspired your fellow man to contemplate facets of life beyond switching insurance carriers. Is there a tasteful limit to how many things worth more than money a person should attempt to acquire? Who has a better job than you? I asked. On that set? Courtney asked. In the world. There are times when I ask myself that, Courtney said. The miserable me who didn't get to audition for SNL never would have known, she said, how good life could be when she was denied what she wanted. I hope that's coming through, she said. I'm screaming it in your face. What sane person wouldn't make the most extreme version of this trade? Tabling any and all creative aspirations, possibly forever, in exchange for free prosciutto, testing well with the general market, the black and the Hispanic communities, delighted co-workers and employers, more than 4 million likes on Facebook, and though tempered with the constant threat of being rendered obsolete by unseen corporate machinations, the peace of having enough. Do we deny ourselves the pleasure of happiness by conceiving of it as something necessarily total, connoting maximum satisfaction in every arena? For anyone with any agency over his or her life, existence takes the form of perpetual bartering. Perhaps we waive the freedom of endless, aimless travel for the safety of returning to a home. Perhaps willingly capping our creative potential secures access to a reliable paycheck. Forfeiting one thing for the promise of something else later is a sophisticated human idea. Our understanding of this concept enables us to sell one another insurance. Katie Weaver is a staff writer at the magazine. She's written about trying to find Tom Cruise, going on a package trip for youngish cup people, and spending time in the quietest place on earth. And now I'll read the Screenland section of the magazine. The Beatles are still charting the future of pop. It looks bleak. Their latest song points toward a future where no golden goose need ever stop laying. It's a story by Peter C. Baker. Earlier this month, alongside the arrival of a new Beatles single called Now and Then, there also came a 12-minute, 24-second promotional film, exactly three times as long as the song itself, explaining the project. Why so long a preface? Part of it was the solemnity of the occasion. This was, the film's title card proclaimed, the last Beatles song. But there was another purpose, too, one that was uncomfortably hard to miss. Now and Then requires not just explanation, but also, awkwardly, justification. The song was originally a demo recorded by John Lennon in his New York apartment in the late 70s, well after the Beatles broke up. In the 90s, it was among the recordings that Yoko Ono provided to Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr as candidates for being polished up into fully arranged songs. Two of those, Free as a Bird and Real Love, were released in the mid-90s as part of the anthology series of television documentaries, compilation albums, and a book. But Now and Then was abandoned, in part because of the technical difficulties in separating Lennon's vocals from the murky piano on the same audio track. This was the audio equivalent of a scribbled note to self, not a usable studio recording. Decades later, though, in the course of making the 2021 documentary Get Back, the director Peter Jackson's production company developed a cutting-edge machine learning application that could be trained to tease apart components of recordings. Suddenly, it was possible to isolate individual Beatles voices from garbled footage of them in studios and rehearsal halls as they conceived and recorded the album Let It Be. Applied to Now and Then, this new technology set Lennon's singing free. The moment when the promotional video evokes this jailbreak, playing Lennon's isolated voice over footage that juxtaposes his face with an empty studio, is admittedly chill-inducing. The video is full of similar juxtapositions. We see the astonishing, well-preserved Paul McCartney of 2023, marveling at the gifts of technology. Then we see him in the 90s goofing around with a still alive George Harrison. Then the bearded family man of the late 60s. Then the fresh-faced Liverpoolian lad suddenly catapulted to stardom. Time collapses. Beatles past and present, now and then come together. Lennon's voice from the 70s layering with Harrison's contributions from the 90s anthology sessions, McCartney and Starr's more recent efforts, even scraps of wordless harmony singing borrowed from 60s recording sessions and tracks like Eleanor Rigby and Because. It's so moving that it took me a few rewatches over a few days to start asking the obvious questions. Centrally, does it really make sense to use a song originally written by Lennon alone, with no known intention of ever bringing it to his former bandmates, as the basis for a Beatles song? Is Lennon's vocal plucked and scrubbed by artificial intelligence and taking on a faintly unnatural air, something he would have embraced or been repulsed by? Is this something we shouldn't do? McCartney asked in a voiceover, but neither he nor anyone else ever articulates exactly what the problem might be. Instead, the film answers unspoken objections by repeatedly swatting them down. McCartney imagines calling his old bandmate up. "Hey, John, would you like us to finish this last song of yours?" And then supplies Lennon's answer for him. I'm telling you, I know the answer would have been yeah. He would have loved that. John would have loved the approach, his son Sean concurs. He was never shy to experiment with recording technology. In the song's music video, directed by Peter Jackson, a youthful Lennon is spliced into the now and then recording sessions. He does indeed look thrilled. "We've all played on it," McCartney says, "so it's a genuine Beatle recording. On one hand, who is more qualified than McCartney to issue this edict of authenticity? On the other, why did he feel the need?" To date, much of our conversation about AI tools and art has focused on what new material a computer program can possibly generate on its own. Can DALL-E spit out a great painting? Can Midjourney create a genuinely good movie? When, if ever, will ChatGPT write an excellent novel? But the successful rollout of Now and Then, within days it was topping charts in Britain and nearly there in America, suggests another and I think more plausible path for AI and the business of culture. This path has less to do with software producing new work, and more to do with tech advances facilitating the ongoing monetization of existing intellectual property, content that is already identified as profitable. We're awash in reboots and rehashes and re-releases, sequels and prequels and spin-offs, movies about toys and toys inspired by movies. And so the recent Hollywood strikes brought to public attention, movie studios are eager for opportunities to assert ownership of writers' and actors' creative output as the fodder and training data for cost-cutting AI tools. This past summer, YouTube introduced a music AI incubator, with Universal Music Group artists including, according to one news release, the estate of Frank Sinatra. Peter Jackson has acknowledged the possibility that the Beatles' archives could, revisited with fresh tools, generate even more new material. This is, after all, the man who stretched J.R.R. Tolkien's slim The Hobbit into three full-length movies. On McCartney's recent tour, he performed duets with Lennon, melding his live show with AI-isolated vocals from a concert featured in Get Back. AI didn't birth rehash culture, but it seems sure to accelerate it. So while the current legacy IP production boom is focused on fictional characters, there are no reason to think it won't, in the future, take the form of beloved real-life entertainers being endlessly represented to help to us with help from new tools. There's always been money in taking known cash cows, the Beatles prominent among them, and sprucing them up for new media or new sensibilities, new mixes, remasters, deluxe editions. But the story embedded in Now and Then isn't, here's a new way of hearing an existing Beatles recording, or here's something the Beatles made together that we've never heard before. It's Lennon's ideas from 45 years ago, and Harrison's from 30, and McCartney's and Starr's from the present, all welded together into an officially certified new track from the Fab Four. In that context, the Now and Then movie's upfront billing of the track as the last Beatles song feels like a two-pronged rhetorical move. As a promotional matter, it maximizes our sense of the release as an event, but it simultaneously functions as a reassuring promise. Look, it seems to say, we won't be doing this left and right. We're too classy for that. We're the Beatles. This is about the realization of a long-standing and deeply emotional artistic goal, not about cravenly generating a new product. Well, maybe. But the truth ultimately will lie not with any facts inherent to the universe of existing Beatles recordings. It will come down to choices made by whoever owns the rights. If you can make a Beatles single using ideas from two dead Beatles, then you can make one with ideas from three dead Beatles, or even perhaps from four. And even if this really is the end for Beatles output, it would be foolish to think that no one will follow in their footsteps. Somewhere right now, people in suits are drawing up profit projections for similar projects from other beloved acts. Whether this fact fills you with dread, indifference, or excitement might depend on what you think of the music that results. Thus far, many applications of artificial intelligence to music have been meme-y novelties. People mocking up surprisingly good impressions of Drake songs, or Johnny Cash covering Taylor Swift, or Hank Williams singing rap lyrics. The next step, the one the Now and Then promotional film is so eager to reassure us the Beatles have not yet taken, is the use of AI to produce songs we're meant to respond to not as neat proofs of what's technically possible, but as vectors for emotion. I've seen numerous people describe how genuinely moved they were by listening to Now and Then. I believe them. And the experience of communing with lost friends and collaborators was obviously an especially meaningful one for McCartney. For me, though, the song is eerily inert. Lennon's original shoddy demo, long available online, is, by contrast, movingly alive, not despite, but because of its incompleteness. The recording generates an aura of possibility that fits with the song's themes, all that might have been, the power of what endures over time, even as so much else erodes. It reminds me of the Beatles without sounding like the Beatles. And why should it when Lennon didn't write it for them? The new Now and Then, for which some of Lennon's original lyrics were cut and others rearranged, doesn't entirely sound like the Beatles either, no matter how much it wants to. The image that formed in my mind as I listened and re-listened was that of a spotless, echoey mausoleum built from shiny gray marble and haunted by garbled digital cries that sound like people I once knew trying to connect across impossible distances. My suspicion is that I'll be having this uncanny feeling more often in the years to come. This will be in part because of what AI will make possible and how widely it will be deployed as a tool for duplicating human sounds. It will also be a result of our ongoing collective failure to create conditions that make the production and widespread dissemination of novel art possible. What's worrisome is not the technology itself, which has the potential to be deployed in all sorts of artistically interesting ways. Neither is it a matter of what is or isn't natural, or of policing the boundaries between real and fake Beatles. The worry is, for the companies that shape so much of our cultural life, AI will function first and foremost as a way to keep pushing out recycled goods rather than investing in innovations and experiments from people who don't yet have a well-known back catalog to capitalize on. I hope I am wrong. Maybe now and then is just a blip, a one-off, less a harbinger of things to come than the marking of a limit. But I suspect that in this late project, the always innovative Beatles are once again ahead of their time. Now read the ethicist. Can I skip my 100-year-old father's wedding? He's making a big mistake. The magazine's ethicist, columnist on how to show up for loved ones even when we don't agree with their choices. My 100-year-old father is about to marry a 75-year-old woman who is a 3-time widow. He met her at church. After 1 month, I believe she pressured him to get married. My siblings and I are all against the wedding. I've spent more time with our father than my siblings have over the past 5 months during their courtship, and I've seen firsthand many red flags. For example, my father loves tennis. He played on his 100th birthday. But now, because his girlfriend is jealous of him playing with other women, he's stopped doing so and is beginning to show signs of decline. We've discussed the potential problems associated with a 25-year age difference, but he doesn't believe that his girlfriend would do anything to harm him because she is religious. I can't attend this wedding in good conscience. My siblings are going, but I'm heartbroken by what I fear this union will do to our father and our family. I don't see how I can put on a phony smile and hug a 3-time black widow as she marries number 4, my father. Am I wrong? And from the ethicist, you've expressed your apprehensions, considered the possibility that your father is less starry-eyed than you suppose. He may simply think that even if his money is part of the draw, this woman's companionship during life's last stretch would be worth it. If you're worried that his health is declining in his 101st year because he isn't exercising as much, see if there's a way that you might be able to help him with this. If you and your sibs have concerns about financial exploitation, consult with a lawyer and explore protective measures your father could take. Sitting out his wedding, however, risks alienating him for whatever time remains to him. So ask yourself why you're prepared to be the lone holdout. When people are upset that their advice has gone unheeded, there are often two things going on. Yes, they're worried that someone is making a bad decision, but they also feel hurt that their perspective hasn't been properly valued. Think about how much you might be affected by that second emotion. Think, too, about how the desire to protect can sometimes turn into a desire to control. Whatever doubts you have about your father's choice, I hope you'll decide to witness his happiness on the big day. Staying part of his life will make it easier to intervene and to support your father if you later see developments that are unambiguously worrying. In the meantime, you might want to get to know your new stepmother better. Maybe she has her good points, too. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.